morning, we have a motion for admission to the bar. Mr. Saban.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, please, the court. My name is Ronald Safe. I am here to move the admission of Thomas Hennahan into the bar of this court. Mr. Hennahan graduated from the University of Illinois in 1994 with his undergraduate degree and from Harvard University Law School in 97. He clerked for the Honorable Judge Conlon from 97 to 98 and then joined Schiff, Hardin & Waite, where he is a rising star, an outstanding lawyer, somebody whose integrity and work ethic will be an honor to this court's bar.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Safer. Your motion is granted. Mr. Hennahan, we welcome you to the bar, and we wish you a long and successful career at our bar. You'll step over and take the oath.
Thank you.
Next case for argument this morning is Lieber against Universal Music. Mr. Wolf.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Your Honor, today I come before you that really in a case that arose out of this court's particular decision, in particular in the Illinois or the International Oil Chemical Atomic Workers in Univen in March of 1999. I graduated law school in May of 99. I began this case in November of 99, and the holding within that case formed the basis, if you will, of what the complaint itself was constructed around. In particular, Judge, I'm here today to raise specific factual errors and errors of law and fact that were performed by the district court judge. One of the things before I came to this honorable court, I asked my plaintiffs, I asked them, I'm coming before the highest court in the land, and what would you like me to ask these? And what they came up with was the fact that, Your Honor, what we have before you today is the Constitution of the Local 352. What is being challenged today is the validity of this Constitution and whether or not this court will uphold the local's Constitution in the face of an attack by the international's Constitution.
I don't understand how that's an issue for us.
It goes to the ratification.
The dispute between the local and the international might be a dispute for the international, or it might be a dispute for the Secretary of Labor. But how is it a question before us in this case?
Your Honor, because it comes before you, this is actually a hybrid suit in which the plaintiffs must prove both that there was a failure of the duty of representation as well as a breach of the collective bargaining agreement in this matter. The premise is...
I don't understand why that's pertinent. I certainly understand that you can't sue on the contract without showing a violation of the duty of fair representation. I don't understand why a dispute about the meaning of the union's constitution has anything to do with the duty of fair representation.
Well, Your Honor, in particular, the specific cases cited in this case state that there is no federal right to ratification of a collective bargaining agreement.
Indeed.
In particular, Your Honor, in this case, the reason that it revolves around is the right to ratify the collective bargaining agreement in 1999. The reason that the local's constitution is so relevant and so prevalent is because within this constitution it provides exactly for that type of ratification. The holdings, as near as I can tell, in all the other circuits have never been directly addressed by this circuit. So what we have before us, Judge, is basically in the fact that the defendants claim that the international constitution trumps the local constitution and as such would extinguish my client's rights to ratify a collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, that's what goes to the breach of the duty of fair representation. They agree that there is no statutory right, but also the cases cited by all the defendants in this matter make it extremely clear that if you have the right to ratify, if it's included in your constitution, if it's included in your collective bargaining agreement, then it is arbitrary, discriminatory, or in bad faith for you to deny these people equal rights to vote. The only complaint that was not, or the only CBA that was never voted on in the history, the 50-year history of this local, Your Honor, was the 1999 NUM CBA that comes before you today. And it is that ratification issue, if you will, that all else flows. The district court basically stated we did not find that to be a breach of the duty of fair representation. The Third Circuit has held that indeed that it would be a breach, but it has specifically never been addressed by this Court of Appeals.
Could you tell me what evidence there is in the record that you suffered harm as a result of the union's alleged inadequate bargaining over the closing of the return center, because the contract allowed Umvidi to close the return center?
Yes, Your Honor. What goes back to is the pre-formation, if you will, that PDSC and Universal, prior to the formation of the company that entered into the collective bargaining agreement, approached the individuals within this local and within this union. The damage flows from the fact that they do have a right to assign it under different terms, but in this particular case, Your Honor, the thing that gives us the damage is the fact that the right to ratification, the right to vote on this collective bargaining agreement, was taken away from them, and from that flowed 184 job losses, which in and of itself create the injury. And that although this specific appeals court has never directly on issue dealt with the issue of an international constitution versus a local constitution. And I would add that my understanding of the law, Judge, is the fact that if there's a specific constitutional statute providing for ratification, the international does not do it, from that flows the breach of the duty of fair rep, and from that flows the injury.
Even if a contract allows them to do something that they do?
Well, that's...
Confused.
Understand, Judge, what we have here is two different collective bargaining agreements, a 1996 collective bargaining agreement and a 1999 collective bargaining agreement. The thing that comes before you is that there were two companies, Universal and Panasonic, that were later to form a limited liability corporation. These two collective bargaining agreements, the 1996, was altered by this company prior to its formation. And then the issue becomes, Judge, whether or not when you take two people who are joint ventures who have not yet formed a limited liability corporation, whether or not if one of those joint venture partners attempts to alter or change the other's collective bargaining agreement, that they would be bound to liability therefore. So it turns around the district court's error, if you will, ma'am, in the fact that he found that Delaware law controls the application of two different companies coming forward, and that I find that was clearly error, that the Delaware law cannot apply to the pre-formation activities simply because of the fact they were not formed yet. This issue is also new before this court because we had...
It's certainly not new. Maybe we haven't considered it recently, but this is one of the most fundamental points of corporate law, that pre-formation activity is governed by the state law of the place in which the entity is incorporated. There's been at least 200 years of litigation about sponsors' pre-incorporation liability. It's been resolved under state law for 200 years.
I understand that, Your Honor. The thing that makes this factually different than is not before the court is what happens when someone who has, Universal has the 1996 collective bargaining agreement and sends its partner to negotiate prior to pre-formation. Then that Illinois law, I believe, Your Honor, because of the fact that they were not a company yet...
Wouldn't be Illinois law, it would be Delaware law. This became a Delaware LLC.
But not at the time that they approached the union, Your Honor. And that Illinois law holds that you will be held liable, and even the district court said that you would be held liable for the dalifications of your joint venture partner prior to its formation.
It's not a joint venture. It's a limited liability company.
Yes, on May 23rd, 1999, Your Honor, but prior to that, there was a contract entered into on May 13th, 1999 by, quote, a new company that had yet to be named. In other words, MUM simply did not come into existence. We have a company who is not in existence entering into an agreement on May 13th, 99, purportedly binding my plaintiffs.
What's your best evidence that Umvidi and Panasonic are alter egos of Mums? In other words, where in the record would we find that kind of evidence?
Mostly, Your Honor, in part it would be in the fact that they admit that they met prior to. The discussions began in 1998 to form this limited liability corporation. And as part of that discussion, they discussed the union contract and the changes to this collective bargaining agreement. In particular, they had a series of meetings which arose in which only one of the future joint venture partners approached the international and did not reveal the fact that it was indeed a partnership. And then further, Your Honor, submitted on for the trial court record, there were a little over 144 affidavits in which detailing the crossover, if you will, the cross-management, in terms of the fact that once these entities were purportedly split, the management was the same, the transfers were the same, the equipment was the same, and that the managers on the new board were also managers under the old board. And that the most important point that I'd like to drive home to this court today is that the company asked for specific changes prior to its formation. Those formations prevented the right of members to seniority to bump through, if you will. I believe it's going to be the union's position that they have the right to dovetail seniority in. The only difference in this case, Your Honors, is the fact that it's the company that asked that the seniority provisions be not allowed to prevent the transfers through. And judges, that leads us right back to Edge and right back to the fact that this collective bargaining agreement in 1999 is to be inseparable with the Edge application to create new jobs. One of the errors that I'm putting before you is the fact that the trial court erred in not applying the specific statutes under Edge to the application.
I actually don't understand how any of these issues is presented in this case. The old collective bargaining agreement was between the union and Universal.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as best I can figure out, Universal was never made a party to this case. Wasn't served with process.
Your Honor, we allege...
Your opening brief, the district court so held, and your opening brief completely ignored that problem, so it's not presented on appeal. Well, with Universal not a proper party to this case, is there anything left?
Yes, Universal is the case of part of this case.
No, it is not. The district court held that it was not served. You did not raise this issue on appeal in your opening brief. So it is not a party to this case.
Now,
would you like to deal with my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is Universal not a party to this case? Is there anything left?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a pre-formation liability of the acts of Panasonic on behalf of Universal. And that, how do you legally describe them, even if you allow the Delaware law to stand, which I believe is incorrect?
So you think everything then turns on a claim that Panasonic was acting on behalf of Universal before the formation of Mums?
On your own admissions, Judge. On your own admissions. But it's confusing in parts in the sense that they, in some ways, claim that it was Mums itself that entered into the May 13th agreement, which, given the fact that Mums cannot be formed until the 23rd, makes it a legal impossibility. I believe the defendants in this case claim that this court should show deference to their expectation of the formation of a Delaware corporation, but that's not what was going on. At the time, there were two separate distinct companies meeting together prior to the formation of any joint venture partnership agreement, both acting in concert on a 1996 CBA that belonged to Universal. The argument goes, yes, Your Honor, we concede that Universal was not served, but in Illinois, service on a partnership is service on the partners. And once again, it goes back to the particular provisions of Edge. And the fact that under this circumstance, because of the nature of the Edge application, the fact that state funding and the definitions for each of these workers are so interwound with the Mums collective bargaining agreement as to be inseparable.
Where in the record will we find evidence that Mums received tax breaks from the Edge program for jobs other than DVD-related positions?
Well, Your Honor, it goes to the actual Edge application itself in that it states but for the language that it would not have been created. What the evidence does construe is the fact that the prior to the formation of MUMS, that all this plant did was produce CDs. That's it. 85% of the work was CDs. After MUMS formation, 85% of the work was still done in CDs. So the majority of the workforce at the time that it was hired was indeed Local 352. One of the errors that the district court made was assuming that none of the plaintiffs before this honorable court had a right to ratify the MUMS 1999 CBA. That's just simply not true. That within the existence of this is that the timing in particular and the fact of how this company was formed and the promises that were made all showed pre-formation activity of particular corporations. And I believe that it's incorrect to apply Delaware law to a company that is not yet formed. If that was the case, the company could be allowed to change its state of incorporation to suit its needs. And that under the provisions, under the ruling of Judge Gilbert, it would present a position where every local constitution within the jurisdiction of the Southern District no longer has any force or weight. That this ruling turns a local constitution into a meaningless piece of paper. In particular, Your Honor, and I'm quoting from the defendants in this case, the liability issues are ultimately ones of federal common law, although relevant state law, if compatible with the purpose of Section 301, may be resorted to in order to find a rule that will best effectuate federal policy. That's the Lincoln Mills case, 350 U.S. 457. Under the ruling of that case, Your Honor, you would have to apply Illinois law. It seems nonsensical that you can apply Delaware law when it's yet to be incorporated. Each of these companies had their own distinct incorporation when they met. One was from California, one was from New York. They both come in, they both Universal and Panasonic agree, and from that agreement flows the fact that Panasonic approaches the union to change Universal's collective bargaining agreement. That goes to the alter ego theory and the single employer status. They were obviously involved in, if you will, the control of labor relations. What they did not tell the union members at the time is that they were Universal's partner. They were not joint ventures. They had not formed it. If what you're saying is true, Your Honor, all of this could have been simply avoided by them filing an LLC before they began to construct this project. And I just do not believe that it's a correct statement of law to let Delaware law control two separate corporations and give expectation to the fact that Delaware law should control. If so, anyone could come into this state prior to formation, adopt any attitude they would choose, and begin to go forward on this. And that ultimately, the company's motivation, the improper motive that this court says needs to be there, lies in the tax advantage that lies in the fact that 184 workers were removed beginning in July, ending in September, and in August, in mid-August, the new company applied for 300 new jobs. My people were equally qualified to take those jobs, and what's really, really the point is that the company insisted that there be no seniority rights be allowed to bump. It was not the international that stripped away the seniority rights, it was the company. And companies do things for one purpose, and that is to make money. And the only logical reason for a company caring whether or not seniority provisions pass across or not is the fact of how they would apply under EDGE. Nowhere in the district court's opinion is there analysis of what the EDGE application does, or in particular, each of the statute lays out what each of these employees should or should not be. MUMS was formed according to their application for a very, very specific purpose. These employees were picked for a very, very specific purpose, and it was all flowed under EDGE. And these promises for this money, the interactivity prior to the formation of May 23rd, were based on promises with companies that did not yet exist. And that there truly, as near as I can tell, I've read everything I could get my hands on, there is simply nothing on this point. When you enter into a collective bargaining agreement, simultaneously entering into a contract with the state of Illinois over those same employees, that under the holding of Lincoln Mills, the court should have to apply the definition supplied by the state of Illinois. My complaint clearly lays out that we are state employees. We are members of the state. We have dual status. Normally, there's a national or a federal prohibition that labor law controls this. With the application edge, though, that changes the law. That the company that formed this agreed in the application to create these jobs. And there goes the improper motive. It was this court's holding in the International Atomic Workers that says if this collective bargaining agreement is split for two corporate improper purposes, or if it was done to avoid taxation or regulation, or if it was done somehow to avoid the collective bargaining agreement, then it was wrong.
You're not arguing, are you, that there's something improper about rooms being created, at least in part, for a tax break?
No, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is the fact that their partner, Universal, simultaneously to their joint venture discussions in January, decided that it would remove 184 of the workers, which MUMS would acquire. The gist of the argument goes is, which story would you believe? Is it a PolyGram merger that allowed the 184? The timing is impeccable. At the same time, Universal's partner is making its decision, if you will, to remove the 184, they're in the end to a joint venture to create 300 new jobs. And the Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Thank you.
Mr. Dedelberg.
Good morning. Joshua Deidelberg, appearing on behalf of MUMS and PDSC. In this case, the appellants seek to bind two non-signatories to the Universal CBA to that contract. The essence of their claims is that they somehow had a right under the Universal CBA to jobs at MUMS, and also that MUMS should have adopted or assumed the Universal CBA as an alter ego or a single employer and the like.
You know, but it seems to me that the question for you is that someone was dealing with the union before MUMS was incorporated. Who was that? An agreement was signed with the union on May 13th, and MUMS wasn't incorporated until May 22nd. Who ought to be liable for those negotiations? If Universal was part of that negotiation, wouldn't they have been obliged to follow the 1996 agreement?
Well, first of all, representatives of PDSC acting essentially as agents of MUM and sort of akin to a pre-formation situation were involved in those negotiations with the union. And the analogy that we made in our brief was akin to a promoter-type situation where it was very clear in the May 13th agreement that the agreement was being made on behalf of NUCO, that to the extent there were going to be any obligations and rights, they would be on behalf of this new company, which then sprung to life and was created on May 23rd. So, sort of akin to what we saw as kind of typical promoter liability, given the intent of the parties that NUCO would be stepping into the shoes and assuming those obligations, then any liability that PDSC might have, as an agent or promoter would drop out of the picture. I think it's also worth pointing out that with respect to Mr. Wolf's pre-formation liability argument is that I'm not sure what liability arose pre-formation. If the issue was a rejection somehow or a failure to assume or adopt the Universal CBA, that was undertaken by MUMS at the time of its formation or post-formation. The gist of the May 13th agreement was sort of a hypothetical or a counterfactual agreement that if certain things happened, then this would form the basis of the ultimate MUM CBA. Before this court, the appellants make no joint employer arguments. That's dropped out of the picture. The only alter ego argument that I discern in their brief has to do with the EDGE program and these tax credits. First of all, in their brief, they accept the fact that that MUMS was formed because of the synergy of these two companies, Panasonic needing a production facility on the East Coast, and Universal trying to find some additional manufacturing capability for a Moorabbin facility. They actually don't disagree with that as a reason for the formation of MUMS. With respect to the tax argument, as we set forth in our brief, the tax credits were applied for the creation of new DVD manufacturing and manufacturing-related jobs. It's undisputed that these jobs and that operation and that technology did not exist at the Pinckneyville facility prior to PDSC and would not have existed at that facility but for PDSC. These were new jobs. The appellants seem to be basing their argument on the fact that the numbers of employees at the Pinckneyville manufacturing facility went down upon MUMS formation and then climbed back up. But that's not surprising because it's undisputed that MUMS did not acquire or need a return center. It's not a retail type of corporation. And that fact is not disputed anywhere by the appellants. As MUMS began to ramp up its new DVD technology, as equipment was installed in the facility and so forth, the employment levels began to creep back up as DVD manufacturing jobs. And there's absolutely nothing in the record, and the appellants have pointed to nothing in the record, to suggest that tax credits were not applied for anything but that purpose. And furthermore, the application for the tax credits wasn't even submitted until months after the Universal CDA was not assumed by MUMS. So there's no causal connection in that respect. On the issue of single employer status, the only discernible argument that I see in their brief is with respect to Mr. Lemley and the draft unexecuted settlement agreements that were floating out there, were never executed. The district court found that Mr. Lemley didn't have personal knowledge of the MUMS transaction or of the ongoing day-to-day relationship between MUMS and Universal and PDSC, and wasn't authorized to settle anything on behalf of MUMS, and simply found that no reasonable jury could find that whatever he did could counterbalance the overwhelming evidence of the fact that Universal and MUMS were not, such integrated enterprises that they didn't have a separate existence. Briefly again on the issue of pre-formation, again, I don't understand what the pre-formation breach is supposed to be, because to the extent that, anything conceivably could have occurred that would have harmed plaintiffs, it would have been at the time of MUMS formation and the fact that MUMS did not assume the Universal Collective Bargaining Agreement. In their opening brief, the appellants do make something of a throwaway argument that MUMS and not PDSC did assume the collective bargaining agreement. We responded to that in our brief, and they didn't pursue it in their reply brief. In fact, they find more interesting this pre-formation argument, which is seemingly directly at odds with that argument. I mean, the notion that there was some sort of breach or some sort of change prior to the time of MUMS formation. And if you look at, to the extent there's any issue about this, if you look at the transaction documents, it's clear that there was no intent that MUMS would assume any liability for any obligations or related to the return center employees. Even if for some reason MUMS were found to have assumed the contract or have liability under that collective bargaining agreement, it still does not help the appellants in this case, because there is a provision of the collective bargaining agreement which, amazingly, the appellants do not even refer to or make argument with respect to in their brief, section 1202 of the collective bargaining agreement. I think Judge Bovner was probably referring to that earlier in her colloquy with Mr. Wolf, which says that there's nothing in there that prevents all or part of the facility from being sold. There are no hiring guarantees. There are no successorship provisions. There's nothing requiring a successor to assume and adopt a collective bargaining agreement. Nor are there any guarantees of jobs for the return center employees. There's simply something akin to a meet and discuss kind of provision in the collective bargaining agreement. And as we argued in our brief, that was fulfilled, that Universal did so prior to MUMS's formation. The appellants make no duty of fair representation argument with anything that happened with respect to those discussions, nor filed any grievances with respect to those discussions. And, you know, if indeed MUMS were to adopt, you know, were seen as adopting or assuming the Universal Collective Bargaining Agreement, they must take the bitter with the sweet, you know, because the May 13th agreement, the September 7th hiring preferences, and the 2001 hiring preferences, which referenced and, you know, adopted in some fashion the 1999 hiring preferences, were all attempts to you know, get to the notion of what to do with these returns employees. As we pointed out in our brief, and appellants you know, did not refer to it in their opening argument, the case, the September 7th preferential hiring agreement also resolved any issues with respect to those employees vis-a-vis MUMS. And the appellants make no DFR argument that that was an improper agreement, and there is no evidence that that is an improper agreement. I think at most, in their brief, they kind of bootstrapped their own grievances, which were not pursued by the union and were denied by MUMS as not being arbitrable. And you know, present no other argument with respect to that. And finally, even if there were some breach, some contractual liability, the appellants have not established a breach of the duty of fair representation, which is a prerequisite to liability on MUMS's part and PDSC's part. Under the circumstances, the union struck, you know, a fairly reasonable deal and quite possibly one of the best ones it could have gotten under the circumstances. It was clear that the return center was going to be closed, and despite their sort of bare argument here, the appellants have cited to no evidence that this was part of some vast conspiracy. Rather, the unrebutted record in the evidence in the record, excuse me, is that this was as a result of the PolyGram merger and a multiplicity of similar facilities. So returns was doomed in some respect. And what at the end of the day did the union achieve? They were able to preserve most of the collective bargaining agreement. They were able to preserve jobs for all of the manufacturing incumbents. And as we said in our brief, and again unrebutted by any evidence on the appellant's part, that's the reason that the returns folks were not hired initially, because MUMS reasonably wanted the incumbents in those manufacturing positions and then made additional job opportunities available later. So the incumbents were preserved, and then down the road, the union was able to secure hiring preferences for the return center employees, which incredibly, as we point out in our brief, only 32 out of the 75 individual appellants have even bothered to take advantage of. So what the union did was certainly within the realm of reasonableness, and we submit, you know, a pretty good deal under the circumstances. So for the foregoing reasons, we ask that the appeal be denied and dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Dover.
Thank you.
Mr. Jokic.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Jokic, and I represent the International Leather Goods, Plastics, Novelty, and Service Workers Union in this appeal. This appeal is styled as a hybrid suit, one that involves an allegation of a breach of contract, one that involves a violation of the duty of fair representation. And the jurisdictional basis of the suit is Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947. I think that if you review the papers that have been filed by MUMS and by PDSC, that it's a pretty compelling argument that there was no violation of a collective bargaining agreement in this case, and that therefore there could be no violation of Section 301. And I also think that even if you could disagree with that conclusion, that the decision of the union not to litigate that through to a time period akin to today in May of 1999 was a reasonable one under the circumstances, and that given that the union decided not to litigate who is an alter ego or a single employer or a joint venture or a pre-formation liability getter, that the union made the best deal that it could at the time all of this occurred, and that therefore there's no breach of the duty of fair representation because the union did not act in an irrational fashion.
Would the record tell us what happened with Ms. Berman, why she was taken out of her position?
There were, there is a, in the record, in the plaintiff's appendix, I believe, there is a decision of the trustee that was rendered in July of 1999, and contrary to what the plaintiffs represent, the decision with respect to Ms. Berman was not influenced by what happened in this case at all. It was influenced by a number of other allegations that were made with respect to the management of the Midwest Joint Board and with respect to other activities that were the responsibility of Ms. Berman. It didn't have anything to do with what she did in early May of 1999. And I would point out to the court that it's very important to parse the timeline in this case, because this lawsuit was brought in November 23, 1999. Well, if you count back 6 months from November 23rd, that gets you to May 23rd, but it doesn't get you to May 7th, and it doesn't get you to May 13th, which is when Ms. Berman went in front of the local union executive board and said, this is what, these are the choices we're faced with, and when Ms. Berman agreed to the letter agreement with the new company. And so, if the plaintiffs seek to attach liability to those actions, I submit that anything that they have is time-barred by the six-month statute of limitations that applies to hybrid suits, which, as the plaintiffs have conceded all throughout, this type of suit is. I think there are two central realities in this case that demonstrate that what the union did was reasonable. One is that a legal reality, and that's that under the Burns case decided by the Supreme Court, the labor law gives great weight to entrepreneurial speed and flexibility, and not especially great weight to the contract expectations of workers. And so when Ms. Berman was presented with what was going to happen, she had to act quickly to save as many jobs and to save as many benefits as she could. There was not time to undertake what was undertaken in this case, which was a four-year litigation regarding who is liable to who, which would have left the collective bargaining relationship in a mess for that period of time. The other central reality is a factual reality, and that is that in early 1999, Universal made a decision that it was going to close the return center. And nothing about the transaction with MOMS or with PDSC altered that fundamental reality. Given the fact that those jobs are going to be eliminated anyhow, what the union did in terms of saving the wages and benefits of the rest of the people that worked at the facility, I think falls well within the range of reasonableness that it has under the duty of fair representation.
Now, the claims against Universal, they're not going to be arguing, so the claims were dismissed without prejudice.
That's right.
Is there a final judgment?
I would say yes.
Well,
being the Universal lawyer, I mean, I know there's a final judgment against the union. The Universal lawyer is here. You can ask him his opinion on that. But I would say that we're about as I would say that it would be very hard to go and reopen the case against Universal at this point, because there's no excuse for not doing the service within the time period allowed by the federal rules. There's been a lot of heat over the denial of a vote in this case. And I'd like to address that in a couple different ways. First of all, the exclusive bargaining representative in this case is the International Union. And the actions of the representatives of the International Union are controlled by the International Constitution, not the local Constitution. Under the International Constitution, there's no right to ratify contracts. That's contained only in the local union constitution. And I think what's key in this case is that the Universal contract was not changed for the people who remained employees of Universal. The people that were who became employees of the joint venture were affected by the new contract. And so the key point to understand is that since the contract of the people that worked in the return center was not changed, there was literally nothing for them to vote on, either under the international constitution or under the local union constitution, because they had not been affected. Now, you might make an argument with respect to the people who were employed by the new entity, that being MUMS, but those people are not plaintiffs in this lawsuit. They don't claim that they were injured in this lawsuit. And so, for the purposes of Section 301 lawsuit, there's just no reason to find liability in this case. And unless the court has any other questions, I don't have anything more to give to the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.